Our speaker is Mary Beth Peters, and after her presentation, we'll accept questions for all three speakers.
Thank you. After listening to the extensive rights that performers have in France, I'm not going to tell you that performers do anywhere near as well in the United States. Let me start by saying that I think internationally there's increased concern about performers and what kind of rights performers have. And certainly at the World Intellectual Property Organization, they're trying to draw up a new international treaty that would raise the level for performers. But it's an uphill battle, and in the United States, it's particularly an uphill battle if you want to include performers of audiovisual works. It's a little bit easier if you want to include performers of sound recordings. Let me start by saying that when you talk about performers, usually what you talk about are actors, singers, musicians, dancers, and other persons who act, deliver, sing, declaim, play in, or otherwise perform literary or artistic works. And the way that it's used most of the times in the kinds of contexts that I'm dealing with is that they're performing works, whether or not they're in the public domain. Things like variety artists and acrobats and sports personalities are not what you're looking at. Traditionally, performers haven't been really very well protected. And I was reading a book about this, and they suggested that maybe it was historical and social, and that actors or strolling players in early days were basically regarded as vagrants and really didn't get very much attention, other than negative attention from the law. And that even Adam Smith and his Wealth of Nations gave basically musicians, players, and opera singers and opera dancers as classical examples of unproductive labor. And then he went on to talk about the fact that the work of all of them perishes in the instant of its production. And maybe that's what's different, that in the early days, when you performed, it disappeared. And so the rights of performers weren't quite as critical as they are today. But today, with new technology, it doesn't disappear. And today, with new technology, many actors and many musicians are getting less and less work because their recorded performances are used over and over again. And some of them, with techniques such as sampling, are realizing that their drum beat or their clarinet sound is in a recording that they never were involved in at all. So there is a lot of concern. I wish I could say that the scene in the United States was great, but it really isn't. If you look at performers in audiovisual works like films or documentaries, those works are audiovisual works. Those works are protected by copyright. They're almost always works made for hire, and it is the producer that is the basically the author under U.S. law, and the owner, and all rights belong to the production company. With respect to the actors, they have their rights, if at all, by contract. But normally, it's the collective bargaining agreement. It's the agreement with the Screen Actors Guild. It's the agreement of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists that are really going to control what kind of payment and what kind of rights those performers or actors have. But in general, it's a right of money to get paid for certain uses of the work. The users are controlled. The yes, no, and how much money is controlled more or less by the production company. Sound recordings is a little bit different. The sound recording, the audio recording, in order to convince our Congress that these were works of authorship, what they had to convince them was that there was something original, something that was somebody's interpretation. And that whole basis is on the performer. And I remember Julie London going to Congress and singing Mickey Mouse as a love ballad that convinced them that it was the interpretation of a song that makes it worthwhile of being protected. So it's the performer's contribution on which the sound recording copyright is based, and add to that what a record company does with regard to production and mixing of sounds. In the copyright law, you would not have found until a couple of years ago the word performer at all. you would find the word author. And when it came to sound recordings, again, all sound recordings tend to be works made for hire. We register thousands of sound recordings each year, and they're all works made for hire. And again, it's the labor contracts that govern how performers are paid and what rights they essentially have. For those of you who were here this morning, I said that sound recordings were not protected by the federal government until 1972. So all recordings fixed for U.S. sound recordings before 1972 are going to be governed by state laws. And every state has at least a provision that says unauthorized fixation of a performer's contribution is wrong, and there's some remedy for it. All state laws have some kind of a provision about the name and likeness of a well-known performer, that if you're going to use it commercially, you have to get that person's permission in order to do it. So there are some remedies for performers for pre-1972, but where a commercial recording was made, more likely than not, the bulk of those rights are vested in whoever produced that recording. So again, in the United States, for most of the works that are fixed in an audiovisual work or in a sound recording, it's the record producer who has the bulk of the rights. In all of our laws, we have a term of basically life of the author and 50 years, but for works made for hire, it's 75 years from publication, so it's a fairly long term of protection. So these performers are entitled to money based on the term of protection for the sound recording or the audiovisual work, but they're not going to be exploiting their works or being able to do anything with them normally. Let me say something about moral rights. Once again, the United States has never been known for moral rights. When it joined the Berne Convention, it basically blinked and said, under state law, contract law, a variety of theories, including the right to make derivative works, and something called 43A of the Lanham Act, which is a mislabeling statute, we believe we measure up to the Berne requirement of moral rights. We put moral rights in our law for certain visual arts works. We didn't put them in for any other work. There's really not been much litigation. With respect to sound recordings, obviously we have nothing. Performers are not authors because it's a work made for hire, so they would not have moral rights protection in the United States. And yet internationally, I have to say, that is one of the critical issues. Under the International Convention, moral rights are not required, and yet moral rights for performers are coming to be a very, very big issue, mainly because of digital technology and what you can do with digital technology. But the test for moral rights is the right of integrity, the right to prevent mutilation, distortion, modification that would be prejudicial to, let's say, a performer's honor or reputation. So it's not just any change or any mutilation. And the other issue is attribution, the right to have your name on a recording. So in the United States, I would say that if you're an archive and you're dealing with pre-1972 sound recordings from the United States, you may be concerned about dealing with a performer. But by and large, it's going to be the record producer that's the owner of the bulk of the rights. It's good to get their permission, but the state of their rights is not totally clear. What we have now is performers mention the copyright statute twice. One, with regard to private copying. In 1992, it was mentioned this morning, we created a Digital Audio Home Recording Act where, for the very first time, the labor unions came in and fought and said, you just don't give the money to the record companies. You give part of it to the creative talent that made the recording what it is. So half of the money of the sound recording goes to the performers, and that money is administered or collected under like a collective management of copyright. There's a group that has been formed to collect the money and to distribute the money. We have a brand new law that mentions performers for the very first time. With regard to the Uruguay round of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, one of the agreements was that there be all nations basically protect the unauthorized fixation of performers' contributions that are fixed in a phonogram, in other words, in a sound recording. You may wonder why they stopped at sound recording. It's called the United States, because the United States doesn't have the broad right in audiovisual works. So when they were dealing with performers in the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, it really stopped with sound recordings. But we now have legislation that went into effect on December 8th, 1994, for all performers all over the world that makes it illegal for anyone who, without the consent of the performer or performers involved, fixes the sounds or sounds and images, if it's a music video, and reproduces those works or transmits them. So where you have an unauthorized fixation, you have a violation. Where you have the multiplication of copies of that unauthorized fixation, the performer has a right. Where you have that unauthorized fixation being broadcast, the performer has a right. That's the very first time that we've had performers actually granted a right that they can enforce. There's also a criminal part of this provision with respect to basically trafficking in unauthorized fixations. That's the only part of the law that's been tried. The United States attorneys have brought criminal charges against unauthorized bootleg copies where you have a performer in a concert, whether it's in this country or not, and somebody makes a copy of that live concert and manufactures a number of copies and is selling them, and our United States Customs Service is stopping those types of copies at the border, and they have been successful. So we haven't seen any criminal cases. Well, we've seen criminal cases brought. We haven't seen any civil cases brought. The civil cases, I guess it would be the performers would have to do it. Their reaction is that this is really good for them. They have for years been trying to have their rights perfected at state law, and it's very expensive and very, very difficult to do. So in the United States, I guess what I would say with regard to performers' rights, at the moment, they're growing gradually. They're really mostly the rights that they have are mostly controlled by the record producer, and the money that they get is one of equitable remuneration that comes through contracts. It's pretty much totally a contractual situation. Hopefully it will change. I mean, in the sound recording area at least, in theory, performers are recognized as authors. In theory, you can argue that that's true with regard to motion pictures and audiovisual works. But that never has come up because audiovisual works and motion pictures have always so clearly been copyrightable. You've had a screenwriter, you've had music, you've had, you know, a lot of different contributions that were clearly copyrightable that you'd never had to stop and say, well, what about the contribution of the actors? So they have never really been talked about as copyrightable authors. So I guess what I would say is that with respect to what I do in the Library of Congress and where we're doing some of the material that we have in the archives, you have to stop and you have to look at who is trying to make use of the work. Are they nonprofit or for-profit? If they're nonprofit, it's a lot easier. What do they want? Do they want a single copy for their own private study, scholarship, or research? If it's a sound recording, it's real interesting. Our library reproduction provisions require, basically permit you to make a copy of a sound recording for an individual where an unused replacement copy is not available. But it doesn't give you that right for music. So here you have, it says it's okay for the sound recording, but it doesn't cover the music, and most of the sound recordings contain music. What we usually do is say, we have to consider whether or not it's fair use to make that copy of the music, usually if it's a single copy of like one song from an album for an individual user, then we consider that that's covered. Same thing with audiovisual works. You can clearly make small excerpts for an individual user for private study, scholarship, and research. Our forms, basically, you check and say that it will be used for no purposes other than that. We try to put statements on the things that we do, that where the copy that you got is made for private study, scholarship, and research, that no further use, especially commercial use, may be made of that without the permission of the copyright owner. For those of you with it there this morning, I think that trying to locate copyright owners to get permission is really difficult, and that's something that I think we all have to work on. I said that Canada had basically a government body that grants licenses, and that may not be the best way to go. But we can't just not be able to use material because we can't find who the owner is. So I don't really have the solution. The thing about users' rights, in the United States, you know, users don't get very many rights. It clearly is much more on the side of the copyright owner, with education having certain specific exemptions and fair use being available for everybody for everything. I thought it would be interesting to stop and so we have more questions, but I would like to comment on the very interesting presentation that talked about what was going on in Australia. In the United States, we could not protect that kind of contribution under copyright. It has to be original. It can't have been around for a long time, so that when you have a lot of the work that's done by some of the American Indians, and you have the artwork, and you have the songs that are folk songs or folklore, they've been there for a long time. So here, it's got to be original. You have to tie it to an individual author, and then you get a term of like 75 years based from the date that it's published, if it's a corporate work or a work of a tribe, as opposed to an individual. And when we've looked around at that kind of thing, we've said we can't put it under our copyright law for that reason, and you'd have to come up with some other theory on which to protect it, like unfair competition. So we're not quite there. I think with that, I will stop and look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions for our speakers? Yes.
At what stage is in the process of recording deemed to be fixed, and does the term fixed have any validity in connection with unpublished recordings and material Grace deals with?
I can answer for the United States. Have I got this on? Fixed is as long as the work is pretty stable for more than a few seconds. But for us, it's the requirement for copyright protection. Unfixed performances, in other words, live performances where an individual performer has not authorized anyone to tape it, would be protected under state law and not under federal law. But fixed is if I make a tape copy of it and a week later I erase it. We've had cases where television archives have had television programming and they only kept the videotape for 1 week. Then they kept the audio longer. And what was infringed was what was on the video. And the court held that it was, in fact, fixed and that they didn't have to keep it in order to bring a lawsuit. And we only require audio tape if it's unpublished. So fixed is more than a few seconds. If you put something in a computer, under our law, in a computer memory, and it's there for like 5 minutes, we'd say it was fixed. So it's very loose.
I think we're seeing an extension of capitalism to new areas and an extension probably of colonialism to new areas, so that a very small part of the world's definition of what an individual is, what knowledge is, and what ownership is being put upon the rest of the world through fiat rather than through negotiation. And I think that precisely the issue of whether an ancestor can have a copyrighted work is an example of what is the nature of the individual and what is the nature of a lifespan. If a god creates something, what is the lifespan of a god? And I think if we don't take seriously other people's definitions of ownership, of concepts, and also of what it is that is in intellectual property, we will in fact be precisely subverting some of the very things we're trying to do with copyright law. And I was wondering if that sort of aroused any response among the three of you.
I'll respond that I don't think anyone is trying to not protect that. The question is, how do you protect it? In the United States, like it or not, we're stuck with a constitution that says writing of an author, protection for limited times. Author is an individual. It doesn't matter if the individual created something in 1500 and it has remained unpublished, it's protected in the United States today. But many of these things have in fact been published in the traditional sense. So it's true that in the digital world, I will argue in the networked environment, I think we're gonna rethink copyright law, and copies won't matter in the way that they did in the past. But I do think for the United States, with the concept of writing and limited times, you're going to have to come up with something else because, you know, we can't get around our Constitution.
Oui, en France, c'est vrai que nous, je dirais, les œuvres sont protégées grâce au droit moral de façon perpétuelle, puisque même, je sais qu'il y a une affaire qui remonte déjà assez longtemps, où les petites filles de Jean de La Fontaine, vous connaissez peut-être les fables, avaient intenté un procès en vertu du droit moral de leur grand-père, puisqu'il y avait eu une interprétation en fait, d'une des œuvres qui ne leur avait absolument pas plu. Donc je dirais que chez nous, la protection est perpétuelle. Et c'est vrai qu'il va falloir absolument qu'on... D'ailleurs, j'étais très heureuse de voir des banques de données où sont répertoriés tous les auteurs et les artistes, parce qu'en vertu du droit moral, si on ne connaît pas quels sont les titulaires de droit, on peut avoir des problèmes, et n'importe quel utilisateur, s'il adapte, s'il fait une modification de l'œuvre, pourra avoir des problèmes.
I just wanted to say that this whole idea of negotiation is what is probably one of the most interesting aspects of what's happening in Australia. And we hope in the next 2 months that there will be a summary of the answers to the questions that were sent out, you know, in the Help Stop the Rip-Offs paper. And I just await that. But that is giving Aboriginal people the right to define their own ideas of what should be protected and how. So I can just say that we await that with great interest.
People come into our archive every day and they're looking for one of two things. Either they're musicians or private individuals who've been looking for a particular piece of sheet music. And they've been to all the dealers, they've called New York, they've done everything, and they can't find it, but we have it. And we make a photocopy for them, and we have them sign a disclaimer. And the same thing is true of an audio recording. We have the disclaimer right on the cassette and so on. Now, of course, they may be lying about what they're going to do with it. So in that case, where does the liability lie if they use that for commercial purposes?
This is a personal view, not a Library of Congress view. I think that the liability is with them, that you can't go behind what they tell you, that when you're an institution and you're dedicated to scholarship and research, that that's what's happening. And if they did it on an affidavit, or you indemnified, got indemnity from them, it wouldn't matter. Ultimately, if they make subsequent use of it, it's their fault. You made the one copy under conditions that we believe would fall under fair use. When they take it and do something else with it, the liability is theirs.
En France, tout au moins je parle pour l'Institut national de l'audiovisuel, la société pour laquelle je travaille, nous ne donnons jamais des copies aux particuliers. C'est une des règles de la maison et ce n'est pas l'objet de notre société. En revanche, si quelque chose comme ça se passait en France, il est sûr que le musicien, enfin l'artiste, serait en droit de vous assigner parce que vous avez remis une copie qui a eu un usage commercial fait derrière, à charge pour vous, après, de ce qu'on appelle de se retourner contre la personne qui aurait effectué la contrefaçon. Simplement, c'est un petit peu dangereux parce que retrouver cette personne, vous aurez certainement des dommages et intérêts à payer à l'artiste. Donc après, il faut vous retourner contre la personne qui a effectué la contrefaçon. Difficile de la retrouver, difficulté, est-elle solvable? Est-ce que vous pouvez lui réclamer quelque chose? Moi, je trouve ça très dangereux, je ne le ferai pas.
Can I just say, we don't make copies of audiovisual works. The whole motion, we would never do that. I was talking more about music.
I'm wondering about the requirements.
That's one too.
I'm wondering about the requirements to notify the copyright holders that you want to reproduce their work. Now, I work at the U.S. Department of Education, and we have what are called due diligence requirements for the banks to collect on what used to be called guaranteed student loans. If they follow the procedures and they try to track down someone that hasn't paid their student loan back, then we'll guarantee the loan if they've gone through these procedures. Now, in the case of copyrights, it may very well be that, say, I wrote some very foolish poems when I was a teenager, and somebody else was trying to reproduce them and says, well, I went to the due diligence requirements, and therefore I can do it. But there may be some way of handling something like this. But I think the best due diligence requirements that you might want to put in by regulation would be something on the order of, well, I think you just put in the law that the ASCAP or some group like that would just generally handle this sort of thing. And that would generally be enough. I think that would take care of most of the financial problems.
That it were so. ASCAP and BMI are collecting societies for public performance of music only. And most of what you're talking about is a reproduction of the work. And finding the copyright owner is fairly difficult. At one point, there was a recommendation that owners of copyrighted work should belong to collectives and collecting societies. And unless they did, and unless you could find them, then the damages that you got would be limited. That's probably a very good idea. It's one that hasn't passed. It's one that we may have to look at in the future. At that time, individual publishers and producers did not like the solution because they wanted to be the ones to individually say yes or no. And to agree that their damages are limited for library copying unless they belong to some kind of a collective was not attractive.
And I have one final question for Mary Beth Peters. In talking about performers' rights, what rights does a performer have to recordings of his or her own performance? For instance, many institutions know they can make a copy of performances held at a school for their archives, and some will routinely make copies of performances for the participants. Others are hesitant and will not do that. And then how does that also work in terms of recordings of 20th century copyrighted works that are for a chorus? Is everyone in that chorus entitled to a performance copy?
No. I can answer that one fast. No. The one where there's an individual or like it's in a voice school, and copies of concerts or copies of lessons are made, or my aunt's an opera coach, of her lessons, where they sometimes record them. The copyrightable authorship is with the performer, and the performer totally owns the intellectual property. And so they're the ones who would have to authorize the making of the copy. But usually it's one copy that an individual has for private study and scholarship. In our law, making multiple copies, it doesn't matter that it's one for every person in a choir. You wouldn't normally need permission. The only time that we ever have multiples is classroom settings. Under fair use, we have provisions that where individuals in a class need something, and there's no time to write and get permission, and it's only going to be used this semester and not next semester, then you can make one copy for every person in a classroom. But no, you'd be getting permission.
Well, thank you for coming, and I'd like to thank our speakers again.
We have right now.
Thank you. Thank you. Very good session. I'd like to extend thanks to Suzanne Stover for stepping in at the last minute and moderating this portion of this program. Thank you, Suzanne. That's it.